The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly, The Guardian's dose of technological vitamins and minerals. I'm Alex Kratosky, and joining me in the pod are Charles Arthur, Bobby Johnson, and Jemima Kish. It's a full house. Welcome back to you all. In news, I managed to catch the video game documentary King of Kong this weekend. It was released last Friday in the UK, and it's about two grown men competing for the world title of Donkey Kong, in 2005, no less. And it did absolutely nothing to dispel the myths about computer game players, to be honest. It was really quite a shocking demonstration. However, it is a fascinating look at the dying art of retro arcade championships and the remarkably bitchy men who inhabit that world. Charles, I know you are a keen squash player. Bobby, I've seen you play SingStar, and Jemima, you run a lot. Is there anything technological that you guys are champions of?
I've got a Blue Peter badge.
I broke a world record the other day on Mario versus Sonic Olympics on the DS.
It's just been released.
Me and the kids, in an effort of supreme teamwork, where each of us did one part of a stage, finally completed Super Mario Galaxy. And as much as we did the final boss stage.
Well, I've never actually got a championship of anything. I've never actually finished Mario Brothers.
I just want them to combine that dancing game you get in the arcade with SingStar, so you can dance and sing at the same time.
As I said, I can claim absolutely nothing, although I did win some sweets during a piano recital when I was 8. Anyway, group therapy over. This week in Tech Weekly, we're talking with Peter Gabriel about his new recommendation service, The Filter, and how could we pass up Apple's Worldwide Developers Conference? We've got the latest on the big announcements and the buzz behind the scenes. Keep your MP3 players on Tech Weekly for these stories and more about this week's technology news, plus your views from the blogs and the mailbox. Don't touch that dial or button. There are so many aggregating services out there that I need an aggregator to keep track of them. I've got one for news, one for blogs, one for photos, one for music, one for videos. It seems a new, useful, personalized service is released every day, but wrangling them is becoming ever increasingly impossible. So what's a girl to do? Jemima, you met with rockstar-cum digital innovator Peter Gabriel to discuss his new service, The Filter. What can he do for me?
Well, we did meet Peter Gabriel, but we also spoke to David Meyer Roberts first, who's the chief executive of The Filter. First off, we started by asking him how it works.
The filter tries to work out what your tastes are, and it filters the whole world of entertainment, so music, movies, web video, and RSS feeds, according to your tastes.
So it's a mixture of automated recommendation and kind of human entry, because you have to tell it what you like, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, there's different ways for us to know about your taste. The sort of Last.fm, Flickster, iMeme type profiles, one way. Or you can actually just tell us what genres you like very quickly through a few slider bars. Or you can download a plugin which sits behind iTunes or Windows Media Player, and it scans your music library, and that way we can also learn a little bit about you. Or you just spend some time on the website and rate things and save them and share them with your friends, and that way we also learn a little bit about your tastes. And the more you're active online generally, not just on our website but on other websites, the more we can learn about your tastes.
Is it not too broad, trying to do music and film and web video? What's the thinking behind trying to corner all of these areas?
It's a good question. I mean, we're not about the different types of media. We're actually about working out somebody's tastes in entertainment. And that's why it's a very different proposition to what else is out there. Is our mission in life is to almost create a passport for each individual, which includes all of their tastes from all of their activity, from all of their accounts, and to use that passport where and when people need it. And to go beyond that, one of some of the exciting stuff we're working on in the lab is not only figuring out your tastes, but figuring out the tastes of your friends that might have an effect on how you discover stuff. So maybe you could discover dance music through your friend Anne and actually use her as a filter because she's much better at finding good stuff than you are. Or you can maybe take that one step further and do it through a celebrity or a DJ, Chris Moyles. Why don't I filter music through Chris Moyles or movies through Chris Moyles? And that's what we're trying to work out, the tastes and how that affects discovery, rather than worrying about we're trying to do too much with movies, music, web video, if that makes sense.
So it's going back to the trusted guide to the web. It's going back to the kind of the human editorial element of recommendation.
It's blending. It's blending artificial intelligence, which we've got the algorithms really trying to reduce the noise, but also understanding that people don't just make choices through, I guess, computer-based filtering. They also want to still make choices through people they trust or brands they trust, you know. So it might be that you love a certain magazine and, you know, Rolling Stone magazine, and everything you do has to be filtered through them, for instance. And we want to have a system that can actually filter anybody's tastes for anybody. So that's a principle. Blending the best of man and machine, I guess, is one of the ways of putting it.
So that was David Meyer Roberts, who's the chief executive of The Filter, just explaining how it works. So then we asked Peter Gabriel how he became involved.
Martin and Rhett were already working on some sort of recommendation approaches. We had a music distribution company in 99 called OD2, and so we used them to design some technology for us. And my partner in OD2, Charles Grimsdale, told me that they were developing the recommendation engine. We'd also had a thing which was called the filter.com, which was sort of dormant, but I'd always believed that filtering was going to become increasingly important as we get bombarded by choice. As Bill Joy said to me, that the first wave is freedom of choice and the second wave is freedom from choice, which sounds fascistic, but actually if you are determining how you are free of choice yourself, that was a sort of starting point. And I'm sure that in the same way we have a disc jockey today, that we'll have a life jockey in the future that helps us make better decisions on everything we do.
It seems quite a commercially structured service, so there's a very obvious potential there. Once something's been recommended to somebody, that they can then go on and buy it. Was that a purposeful kind of way that the system was structured?
Well, it's also to avoid frustration. If you discover something you like and you can't buy it, then it's a big hassle to have to traipse around other sites and find it. So there are various ways in which we're trying to find to sustain and pay for the filtering.
Recommendation is really the logical next stage of the internet really becoming that much more usable. Yeah. And CBS buying Last.fm for £141 million was really kind of proof of that. Can you talk a bit more about kind of recommendation and personalisation and how they make the internet usable?
I mean, one of the things that makes us a bit different is that we're trying to integrate both expert systems, sort of machine approach and human being. You know, that most of us have people that we know are better informed or have great taste in certain areas that we would love to get that sort of available to us at all times without ringing them up and bothering them. So I think that's a sort of small practical example, but any sort of navigation really, I think, requires good filtering. And the number one commodity for most of us is our own time. So anything that gets you to what you want or what you didn't know you want but are delighted with or excited by or shocked by, whatever it is you choose, quicker must succeed in the internet. And I think to us it seems to make sense that you try and sort of integrate man and machine in this way.
That was Peter Gabriel discussing The Filter with Jemima. I find this kind of service fascinating because, yes, it is extremely useful, but at the same time I have a fear that people really don't want to learn anything new. They're very happy to just kind of go online and find exactly what they want and never kind of go outside that little silo. How is this different?
Well, also, I think a lot of us naturally reject the idea that our tastes can be classified or pigeonholed in any way. But, you know, like it or lump it, if you're into Tom Waits, you're fairly likely to be into other sort of out there experimental kind of music. I mean, that's just the way it is. I don't see it as something that's going to limit your taste, though. I do see it as an essential way of navigating the amount of content that's out there.
But it is interesting that there's a lot of, you know, critics of the web when it comes to consuming, well, primarily information, consuming information as opposed to media. They do say that there's this kind of cyber balkanization associated with the net. You go in and you only look at The Guardian, for example, and that gives you one type of news, one type of information. And I'm wondering about how that will continue people to only looking at one type of information.
But however much time we spend online, we're always going to be spending time offline as well. And that, I think they were quite keen to emphasise that this is a combination of human and machine. And alongside the rest of our lives and the conversations we have in the pub and people saying, oh, you've got to hear this album or read this book or whatever, I think they sit together really well. And especially if you're sort of, if you know you've got a couple of friends who are really, really good at picking up new music or films or something and you trust their opinion, I think it can only make that more efficient.
I think as well that, that this type of aggregation, this type of filter, as it were, is a similar concept to how media has developed over time. You know, people read The Guardian because they want to find out The Guardian's opinion about cars, about environment, about politics, technology, etc. So how do you think the internet might expand this filtering and create a space that isn't just replicating the traditional media outlets and platforms?
You mean picking up on new bands and things?
Yeah.
This monitors what people are playing as well as what people are buying. And if people are playing new bands, which they will be, then they'll be picked up. I think this is quite good for new stuff.
I wonder whether it's something that's really going to work for me. I mean, my music tastes go from Queens of the Stone Age via King's Crimson to Glenn Gould playing Bach. You know, where's the common ground in that? It's like a mathematical problem where you have multi-dimensional problem and you're trying to map one onto the other. Do my tastes overlap with anyone else's? It's one of those things I think is impossible to say. Predict new music.
Although if you're talking about a network of millions of people, there is likely to be some people in that who have tastes which are similar, if not the same as yours.
Do I want to listen to the same things? I mean, the element of serendipity, the happy accident where you come across something you weren't expecting to find or like, the really useful thing.
Maybe they could add a wild card element to the recommendation.
I also think we all want to believe we're unique, like every other snowflake, you know. But actually,
after me, we're all unique.
The truth is that there are trends and there are patterns, and you know, bands don't come out of nowhere. They're marketed and they're carefully constructed and sold in particular ways. Okay, making use of that might not feel great, but if it gets you listening to a band you like, who cares?
Darkness. It's true.
And
though,
also,
you know.
Can I just make one thing?
One
imagine
more point,
if it was Phil Collins and not Peter Gabriel who was doing this kind of stuff, where would we be then?
Well, on that dark note, thank you very much to Peter Gabriel, not Phil Collins, and David Meyer Roberts from The Filter. Now, Jemima, please continue your pod domination with the news.
UK internet service providers will need to give more accurate information about the speed of their broadband services under a new voluntary code published by Ofcom. 32 ISPs will now need to give more advice about speeds, download caps, and help to resolve technical faults. In a new exchange of letters, Yahoo chairman Roy Bostock accused Carl Icahn of manipulating facts around the breakdown of Microsoft's takeover deal, while Icahn claims Bostock's board sabotaged it. Icahn is leading a group of shareholders who want to push the Microsoft takeover through, and both sides are preparing for a showdown at a meeting on August the 1st. The BBC is working on a live web service for its TV channels, which will be broadcast through bbc.co.uk. The move is a first for the BBC site, although ITV has been simulcasting since last summer. PlayStation 3 will be running in-game ads after Sony signed a deal with IGA Worldwide. Ads are likely to be on billboards and sponsored vehicles, as well as product placement inside games including EA's Need for Speed, NBA Live and Madden NFL.
Thanks very much, Jemima. So looking at the broadband service, Charles, can you talk a little bit about what they're going to be doing here?
Well, it's a voluntary code of practice where ISPs will have to sort of have one of those little asterisk things where it says unlimited 8 megabits, you know.
8 megabuckets.
Yeah, fantastic, incredible downloads and you'll, you know, it'll be just amazing. It'll have to say in the asterisk, unlimited may mean limited. And 8 megabytes or megabits may mean up to 8. And it'll, you know, it's basically all aimed at getting them to stop promising the earth when actually all they've got is a small bucket. The problem has been that people have said, you know, I was promised 8 megabits and I'm getting 2 or I'm getting 1. And the reality is that you have to go and do things like using BT's broadband checker at bt.com/broadband to find out what your likely ADSL speed is.
It's also about letting people downgrade much easier. So if you sign up for something and realise you can't actually achieve the speeds you want and you want to downgrade to a package that still covers you but is cheaper, it's voluntary. There was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing, and it looked like at one point Ofcom was going to have to make this a mandatory. They were going to say, you know, you don't get to sign up to this, you have to sign up to this. But it doesn't cover things like mobile broadband, which is getting more popular all the time. And there are still people who aren't signed up to it. And I think we've got to see how this plays out. I think consumers aren't necessarily going to get the best deal out of this code.
This is going to be my question. This is ultimately a correction, a marketing correction. How is this going to actually affect the consumer in any way?
the downgrade thing is actually going to be the most useful, because as BT starts rolling out its ADSL 2+, which is up to 40 megabits, if you're very, very close to the exchange, but actually looking at the numbers, we did a graph and actually most people won't see a great benefit from ADSL 2+. They would actually do better if ADSL 2+ is being marketed for more money and just sticking with ADSL 2, which one would expect would be cheaper.
Well, I expect, speaking of expecting, that we'll be covering this more in the future. But just to move on, I wanted to talk briefly about the BBC. Jemima, you mentioned that this is a service that's already out there, but the BBC's relationship with them is fractious.
Yeah, there's a company called Zattoo, which operates across Europe, and it's a live streaming service for TV across various different countries. But they've managed to find a convenient, well, they don't like the word loophole, but they say that public service broadcasters in the UK can be rebroadcast for free by other services. But the BBC aren't really very happy about this, and I think they're trying to close that loop in their terms.
And, so, yeah, and do it themselves?
Basically, yes. I think the terms are that as long as you don't store it, so it's not a catch-up service, you're allowed to do it, but they're going to be wanting people to go through their portal. So, yes, they're closing it down. I don't know why they didn't do it sooner, but everything takes forever on the BBC, doesn't
it? And we've also seen this in music downloads. You know, there are certain services that we can't have over here because of, you know, the difference in international streaming, etc. So, again, they'll close this this unfortunate loophole, I'm sure. Mm. Charles, I wanted to go back to you and ask you, just briefly, I swear this Yahoo story is looking more and more like King of Kong. Really, just, it's remarkable, the similarity. So what? Just
well,
briefly,
you know, set your watches for August 1st, because that's when the big showdown is going to come with Carl Icahn, who's looking to replace all the people on the Yahoo board and get his own people in so that they can get taken over by Microsoft. The wonderful meme going around at the moment is Carl Icahn should bid for McDonald's and try to get Ina Fries to be the chief executive, because then you could have the headline of Icahn has cheeseburger. Do you want freeze with that?
Hey! Very, very good.
Here all week, thank you.
Yeah, indeed, all week. You can catch up on the latest headlines, hear more of Charles's amusing quips, and read more about all these stories at guardian.co.uk/technology. The internet has been all aflutter with blog posts, feeds, and other digital ephemera chronicling Apple's Worldwide Developers Conference held earlier this week in San Francisco. So to start this item with a suitable hook, here's Steve Jobs on stage at the conference on Monday.
So, as we arrive at iPhone's first birthday, we're gonna take it to the next level. And today we're introducing the iPhone 3G.
That was Apple Chief Executive Steve Jobs making the announcement about a new iPhone on Monday night. Now, you could hear the crowd going wild, but nearly everything that had been predicted over recent weeks and months came to pass. Higher speed 3G connections, more applications, GPS satellite navigation, but most dramatically, a huge price drop. A standard 8GB iPhone will now cost just £99 on the most common £35 a month contract, and it will even be free if you're spending more than £45 a month. But what does it all mean for Apple, for the phone companies, and more importantly, for you? I asked Richard Ray, The Guardian's communications editor, what he made of the announcement.
To be honest, it was slightly underwhelming. A part of that was to do with the fact that we knew most of the details already. But one of the most interesting things for me was what they've done, or the changes that they've made with the pricing of the actual phone. A lot of the features were expected and were sort of widely trailed. The big change was the fact that you can now get it free if you're willing to spend £75 a month on text and voice and using the internet. And it's the fact that they've replaced what used to be getting money from the operator over time with an actual subsidy for the handset first time, so you can get it now for free.
Is this Apple backing down, changing tack? What made them come to this decision?
The assumption is they'd set a target of 10 million phones within the first year, or within a year, which everyone took to mean basically by Christmas of this year. And that's only a very, very small percentage of a market which is over a billion phones a year. That's quite a good figure for a test, a sort of test bed of how big or how important the iPhone could be. But actually, if they really wanted to make a serious effort in this market, they need to sell an awful lot more phones than that. And unfortunately, unfortunately, because the mobile phone industry is a closed industry where if you don't work with the operator, you don't get in, the assumption was that they'd have to give more to the operator than they already were, which seems to be what they're now doing. The operators have said, OK, we'll subsidise it, we can make it free, we can really push it to all our customers, can you make enough? It turns out the Far Eastern manufacturers can, and they can really push it out and go for a much larger market. The odd thing, I suppose, about the announcement was they didn't set a new target, because what they've had so far is they've had pretty much a large slice of a small market. What they're now going to get is a small slice of a very much larger market, and that's really where the money's going to be.
You know, the iPhone started off at $599 for an 8-gig iPhone, and I'm really happy to tell you that the iPhone 3G is going to sell for $199.
So if this is an effort to beat those earlier sales targets and sell iPhones to more ordinary people, is it going to work? I asked Charles whether he thought the change would help the iPhone take on the Nokias and the Blackberries of the world.
The price is very substantially lower than the Blackberries now. I think the Blackberries are about $350 in the States, whereas Apple's now got the iPhone from next month around about $200. So yes, on price it competes well. The one thing I do feel, though, is these two words, credit crunch, because America's really starting to feel this now. £45 a month in the UK, $45 a month in the US, initially sounds okay, but how sustainable is that? How many people are going to think, actually, I'm quite happy with what I've got? Apple is very much a consumer demand-led company, and if the consumers aren't buying stuff, then its business model, you know, tends to slow down substantially. That happened in 2001, and Jobs said, well, it's the cycle, guys. This is how it is. And I think the cycle is coming around again.
We have a few new features in the iPhone 2.0 software that I'd like to highlight for you as well. The first one is contact search.
But if the raison d'etre of the iPhone was that, in fact, it's a software-based phone, why did we need to see a hardware change at all? And why aren't we seeing some of the simple improvements like more Bluetooth support or cut and paste that customers are desperately crying out for?
This is going to be great.
Writing mobile phone software is something where you have to get it really right, really first time. And possibly that's a discipline that Apple is discovering. And it's quite possible they just didn't want to mess with it. Doing things like MMS, doing things like all the Bluetooth profiles, doing things like call forwarding, video calling, is difficult. You have to burn this stuff into ROM. If you get it wrong, then you're really stuffed because you've got millions of phones out there which don't work. So one suspects that they figured it'd be better to leave well alone, don't change the camera, don't offer these new facilities, even if people want them.
So are we seeing Apple change its business model and turning it on its head because it's failed to get what it wants from the mobile industry?
The original idea was Apple wanted to make money sort of on an ongoing basis from an O2 customer over the 18 months. That's now seems to have changed, that instead of that money being paid to them, that recurring revenue is going to come from the application developers. So when I get my iPhone and I switch it on, I go onto the iTunes store and I can pick applications and start buying those. And each application that I buy, Apple will actually pay that developer for that application but get money themselves. I mean, they're basically acting as a shop, really, so getting their commission. So as I use the phone more, I use more applications, Apple gets more money for me. And that does seem to be a real change in the way that the iPhone is working. When the iPhone arrived, it was, this is going to revolutionise the market, change the way that the mobile phone industry has worked, really scupper the operators. And now it seems to be going back to that traditional mobile model with this adjunct on the side, which is software development. But everyone is desperate to get into that. Microsoft's been trying it for ages. I mean, Nokia would love it if we had more application developers for some of their platforms. But to be honest, they're so extremely complicated, we don't get as many applications as perhaps we should have.
It's finally here. The first phone to beat the iPhone.
So we'll see what happens when the new iPhone comes out on July the 11th. But it certainly looks like it's going to be an interesting few months for Apple, with the world poised to see if it can really become a serious player in the mobile world now that everyone is playing the game by the same rules.
Introducing the new iPhone 3G.
Thanks to Charles Bobby and to Richard Ray. There's more on the site at guardian.co.uk/technology.
I'm Alok Jha on the latest Science Weekly podcast. Science writer Piers Bozzoni tells us how to build our own spaceships and the future of personal space travel. Also in the show, behind the scenes at an animal research lab. Plus, a cure for hay fever, dancing bees, and more science haikus. That's Science Weekly from The Guardian at guardian.co.uk/audio.
There has been so much going on at Guardian Blog Central that we could fill an entire program with your words of wisdom. As it stands, we'll have to keep it to under 6 minutes, so talk lots and talk quickly, people. Jemima, what's happening on digital content?
Well, we had some more fallout from the bbc.co.uk review. We asked Stephen Barnett to come in and write a piece for us. He's Professor of Communications at Westminster Uni and fairly pro-BBC, so it was a nice balance to the piece by Ed Roussel from The Telegraph, which was a little bit more critical, shall we say. One of the lines from Stephen Barnett was, "Yes, the BBC distorts the market, just like the NHS distorts the market for private healthcare and the post office distorts the market for delivering letters." So you can see he's quite pro-public service. So Ivan Pope requoted that line and said, "Well, for sure, that's some sort of argument in fields where supply is crucially dependent on a monopoly or state intervention, like healthcare or comprehensive postal deliveries. In the case of online media, it's really an argument for nationalisation. Of course, it's quite amazing that an arm of the state actually manages to deliver a quality service that the public love. But they do spend over £100 million of tax money to deliver it. And there are implications across the economy that is organised like this."
Bobby, what have you been up to on technology?
You'd never think it. Just a few pixels caused such uproar. But Google changed its fav icon recently, which is the little tiny little block that comes up on your browser.
I thought it was a fav icon.
I'm thinking favicon.
Super Famicom. This is a non-super favicon. Anyway, it's the favourites icon, and they've changed from a big, strong, googly symbol to a little
squiggle,
a little lowercase
capital letter to a lowercase g, which we had already.
Yeah, and so you know they've gone for the lily-livered liberal option. But there was an interesting discussion that came out about it, and you know how on earth did they make something that you know it's a G? How can they make it look so rubbish? I had to put a good word in for Sacco, who stood up not only for the Guardian's icon, but also for our search engine, which you must be mad, my friend. Then it developed onto a different subject. This post was by Jack, by the way, which is kind of crucial here. Sutakin said, "I too have wondered about Jack's pipe. Is it a prop? Does he inhale? What is a pipe's carbon footprint per puff? Do intellectuals and boffins still smoke them? And has anyone cool ever smoked a pipe?" Now, I think this is something our readers and listeners are all really interested in. And he does use the pipe. It's not just
Tony Benn has
was,
a pipe.
Exactly.
He's
I
cool.
mean, this was a response on the blog, in fact. It was Tony Benn, he's cool.
Well, over on the Games blog, we've had a couple of comments. Keith posted about a web version, or a sort of a web spin-off, I suppose, of brain training for the Nintendo DS. It's called Fit Brains. It's completely unrelated to Nintendo. But there are various things that you can do on it very similar to the Nintendo DS, including speaking to it and sort of literature and language and things like that. And Wazbazkuel, pardon me if I've mispronounced your bizarre name, says, "Prediction, in 5 years' time, all our kids will be speaking American and using words like faucet and fender." The answer to the illustrated question is cupboard, but you would need to enter the closet. I know English language is a mishmash of words from all over, i.e. toilet, but this kind of thing winds me up. I can feel the venom in his voice. And personally, I don't really know what's wrong with that because the word is actually pronounced aluminum. It is. It's pronounced aluminum. It is. It's pronounced aluminum. Yes, it is.
Nil point.
No, speak to Bill Bryson. It's all about aluminum. So, yes.
He's more American, for God's sake. You can't trust what he says.
I think we did insert an I in there for the British audience.
You people inserted an I. So if you have something to say about that, do get in touch. Anyway, Charles, what did you find out on Technology Blog?
I had an entry about how the BPI and Virgin have, as I put it, teamed up. Three strikes and you're educated. Which is that if the BPI finds an IP address which is being used for the purposes of file-sharing music, it'll send the IP address to Virgin, which will then send a letter to the owner of the IP address saying, you know, your connection is being used for music file-sharing. To which C.S. Clarke put a thoughtful response, which is, there's always going to be a hardcore who will kill copyright with their mouths, but I can't see every user putting the letters up on a website just to laugh at them, especially as it serves not just as a reminder of the law, but also the fact that they know where you live. But the chap who decides against just downloading or even just cuts down after getting one of these isn't going to be in the papers. Whereas I'm sure there's going to be a healthy wave of Virgin threatens 82-year-old grandfather stories. And naturally, a healthy wave of this won't stop every single downloader, so it's pointless comment pieces. I mean, I have to say, I think he's very right about the fact that there'll be absolutely no mention of the people who give up downloading as a result of getting one of these letters, but there will be plenty of coverage when you get the 82-year-old grandfather who gets one in mistake.
I shall be covering it.
I could see you with your pen poised. Well, going on with that, actually, Charles, we got a comment from Adam via our mailbox, which is tech@guardian.co.uk. He's a massive Nine Inch Nails fan. And his take on mega music stars and the new online economy is that he says you could argue that as they are massive and hugely rich, that they can afford to just give away their music for free. But since bands see so little revenue for their music sales these days, most of their revenue comes from image rights, ticket sales and merch sales. I think DRM free music shared over BitTorrent is not detrimental to our music scene. It is the future, he says in all caps, and it is a future that is not controlled by massive companies that influence creative control over their artists. And just briefly, I'm not going to read all of it, but a new listener, Mike Scott, I like this comment on our Facebook wall, which is I Love the Guardian's Tech Weekly podcast. It says, I'm so far behind on listening to the pods, it's like I'm listening to Look Around You. I quite like that. And I've never been compared to Peter Serafinovich before, but I think we should take that as a compliment. So, there are a gazillion ways you can contact us and engage in that Web 2 conversation. Head over to the blogs at guardian.co.uk/games/technology/digital-content. You can email us, tech@guardian.co.uk. You can leave a note on our Facebook wall at I Love the Guardian's Tech Weekly podcast, as Mike did, or you can call us up on our Skype line, Guardian Tech Weekly. And if you don't want to participate but still want to stalk us in our off time, do follow us on Twitter, which is GuardianTW.
In Thursday's tech section with The Guardian, the US Army is working on killer robots that could be used in battle. They're not huge, but could deliver a lethal blast, and they've been tried in Iraq. We have the details. We examine a little notice changed in the UK's banking code. It says that now, if money is stolen from your account and your antivirus software isn't up to date, the bank doesn't have to refund you. A report from Trials by BT of the technology that would serve ads based on what websites you visit is leaked via WikiLeaks. We rake over it. And Japan's flawed green revolution. It claims it wants to be green, but Japan is actually anything but. It's all in Thursday's tech section with The Guardian.
Just before we leave you, let's find out what's coming up this week in technology. Jemima, what have you got lined up?
We have a very interesting series of internal discussions and seminars on at the moment called The Future of Journalism, and a lot of that is about technology and journalism and what the internet means for all of us and, you know, whether we'll still have jobs and all that kind of thing. But we've got some fantastic speakers lined up for this. So we're blogging the whole thing on PDA. We've already had Jonathan Zittrain, who's the Professor of Internet Governance and Regulation at the University of Oxford, as well as Harvard and lots of other places. We're also going to have an interesting panel on ratings chasing and CERT that's going to include Danny Sullivan from Search Engine Land. Other speakers include Andy Carvin from NPR and a lot of The Guardian's most interesting columnists as well, including Marina Hyde, who I'm a very big fan of. So, yes, lots of coverage of that.
Excellent. Bobby, what are you doing?
I am chairing an event at the Dana Centre about identity theft, and I'm going to have my first weekend at home in ages.
That has nothing to do with technology.
What's that got to do with it?
No, because I'm
going to
spend it playing Lego Indiana Jones.
There we go. I've interviewed Alex Fleetwood, who's the producer of this year's Hide and Seek Festival, which is happening around London's South Bank in a couple of weeks. Plus, Steve Wiebe, who is the protagonist in King of Kong. I'm sorry, I'm so excited about this movie. It's fantastic. Anyway, he was the first man who cracked 1,000,000 points in the Donkey Kong arcade game.
Did it go back to zero then?
It does, it goes back to zero. And then there's something called the death screen, where you only last for five seconds. Anyway, moving on, there's a whole bit in the movie about it. I'm not owned by the movie company, by the way. But we are running a competition for the movie on Thursday on the Games blog. Charles, what are you doing?
Well, I'm talking to someone from Webroot tomorrow, which is one of the security companies online, kicking the tires of all the announcements from the WWDC with Apple. And I'm also going to be playing around with various bits of kit, including a some kit from Logitech for transmitting music around your house, and also one of these record everything onto a hard drive and then play it back through your TV sort of gadgets.
Oh, Well, there's a lot going on, except in Bobby's world, where he'll be playing Lego Indiana Jones.
I live day to day. I can't tell you what's going to happen. Yeah. Can't possibly say.
It's almost enough to make you cry. But before you reach for your tissues, you big lovable lugs, I'd like to say thank you very much to our podcasting team, Bobby, Charles and Jemima, plus producer Scott. And of course, to our guests, Peter Gabriel and David Meyer Roberts, and of course, Richard Ray. Join us next week when we dissect digital identity theft and we'll hear from web entrepreneur Kevin Rose, creator of Pounce and Dig. I'm Alex Krotowski. See you next Tuesday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.